Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the predictable announcement from the FBI Director James Comey that there was nothing to implicate Hillary Clinton in the emails under investigation between her close aide and Huma Abedin's estranged and disgraced husband, Anthony Weiner. Kurt Eichenwald, a senior writer at Newsweek, where he has an op-ed, FBI Director James Comey is unfit for public service, joins us to discuss the extraordinary arrogance of a public servant who thinks his reputation is more important than his duty. We will look into the blithe disregard Comey appears to have for the consequences of his need to protect his reputation of integrity and his image of one who rises above politics to the point where he would tip the scales in a close election in the home stretch, then at the last minute say there was no there there after reviving the endlessly overblown Hillary Clinton email pseudo-scandal. Then we'll assess how much the press enabled the political impact of the Comey letter by falling for Republican Congressman Jason Chaffetz's framing of the letter as a reopening of the Clinton email investigation that in just a few days reversed Clinton's momentum towards the presidency, cutting her probability of victory from 85% to 65%. Eric Bollett, a senior fellow at Media Matters for America, joins us to discuss the ultimate absurdity of so-called balance in the mainstream media that has devoted four times as much airtime to covering Hillary Clinton's emails as they have spent covering all campaign policy initiatives from all candidates for the entire year. Then finally, we will speak with Arthur Lupia, Collegiate Professor of Political Science at the University of Michigan and author of Uninformed, Why People Seem to Know So Little About Politics and What We Can Do About It. He joins us to discuss what steps can be taken to address the deep-rooted problem of an uninformed electorate and to educate low-information voters who, while well-meaning and even passionate about their beliefs, know very little about politics and government. And joining us now is Kurt Eichenwald, who is a senior writer at Newsweek and a New York Times bestselling author. He previously worked for 20 years at the New York Times as an investigative reporter, columnist, and senior writer, and is a two-time winner of the George Polk Award for Excellence in Journalism and was a Pulitzer Prize finalist in 2000 and 2002. He's the author of The Informant and 500 Days, Secrets and Lies in the Terror Wars. And he has an op-ed at Newsweek, FBI Director James Comey is unfit for public service. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kurt Eichenwald.
Thanks for having me.
And let me begin with the conclusion to your op-ed. Fixing the damage Comey inflicted on the FBI will take a long time. So long as a man is in charge who thinks he's always right and cares more about his personal reputation than his duty, the repairs cannot begin. Comey must be fired. But let's wait until November the 9th. What do you think is going to happen on November the 9th?
Well, that was just my recommendation.
Well, I know I know you're not omnipotent.
Takes it or not.
Right. You're not Donald Trump. You can't wave a magic wand, but still.
No, there's no question that Comey needs to be gone. What he has done has, you know, demonstrated that he is the most out of control FBI director since Hoover. And, you know, you cannot have a man in office who is so unaware of what his actual job is, who is so reckless, who is so willing to put his own, you know, self-proclaimed fidelity to truth ahead of, you know, his actual responsibilities.
Well, he's already, we all know about the moment at Ashcroft's bedside that sort of made him famous, and I don't know whether it contributed to President Obama hiring him, but he has rebuked Obama on a couple of times, or at least contradicted him, over reforming mandatory minimum sentences, and he also rebuked him or contradicted him when he talked about the Ferguson effect that is restraining police officers from doing their duty at the time when President Obama was trying to address the fact that young black men in this country were being shot by police. So But nothing, I don't think, rises to what he did with Hillary Clinton in terms of in exonerating her. And after all, he's a law enforcement official. He then went into this totally gratuitous tirade about her administrative and management characteristics, criticizing her as though she were a bad CEO. And I found that extraordinary. Now, the excuse people have given is, well, there's a revolt inside the FBI. They wanted to indict her, and therefore he had to placate these people. Do you buy that?
No, it's total garbage. And it's also, it would be like saying, well, people inside the military really want you to use that weapon. It's not his job to decide. And it's not, you don't make decisions because there are people working for you who don't know their jobs. If they don't know their jobs, fire them. The reality here is all of these excuses for why Jim Comey did what Jim Comey did are not true. The reality is Jim Comey did it because he thinks he always knows best. The entire story of Jim Comey, you know, that story of him refusing to sign the document on the NSA surveillance program, for instance, you know, it's just a mythology built up by him. Yes, that happened that night. And then they made a couple of fixes and he signed it. But that part of the story, Jim Comey doesn't tell. He tells the, you know, brave man standing by, you know, by his principles. And there's a reason why, even before Comey started his first day, and there's a quote I put in there in my column today, somebody in the Justice Department said, we are going to see this guy go out of control. And it became exactly that. I mean, those things where he was basically arguing with the President of the United States about mandatory minimum sentences, about the Ferguson effect. There was also something about going after the, you know, encryption system for to get an iPhone opened. All of these things were outside his swim lane. This was not his job. And he not only was going outside his job, but he was also reciting things that were false. Everything that he said about mandatory minimum sentences had been disproven before he spoke. Everything he said about the Ferguson effect had been disproven before he spoke. When he went after Apple in order to get the iPhone open, he was told by the White House and the Pentagon, don't do this because we are working on a government-wide encryption program, and doing what you're doing is going to endanger that. He said, I don't care, and he went off and did what he was going to do. This is all not the job of the FBI director. And the arrogance that he demonstrates and the self-righteousness that he demonstrates is the absolute conviction that he can never be wrong. And, you know, you go through his statements over the years, and it is not hard to see. It makes him unfit, but also made it completely predictable that he would do what he did in the Hillary Clinton circumstance. And this is not a political argument, and that's something that people seem to have a lot of trouble understanding. It doesn't matter if he was going after John Dillinger or Hillary Clinton. What he did was break with all tradition for the Justice Department. His job, his sole job, is to investigate, to have the people who investigate actually report to him. They then decide whether or not they think there's enough evidence in order to recommend prosecution. They write a memo up, which goes to the prosecutors. The prosecutors review it and decide whether or not that evidence rises to the level of being worth presenting to, you know, a grand jury in order to secure an indictment. They then go to the grand jury and secure an indictment. If the FBI is asked at any point about what's going on, their job is to say, we don't talk about ongoing investigations. If in an extraordinary circumstance, they complete an investigation without making a referral to the Justice Department and feel compelled to announce that, their job is to say, we did not develop enough evidence to justify a referral to the Department of Justice. And that's it. Comey wanted to appoint himself everything. He wanted to appoint himself critic. He wanted to appoint himself prosecutor. He wanted to talk about whether or not an indictment should have been brought. He wanted to talk about what prosecutors would do. He went on and on and on and on. Then he dumped all the files into the public view, which of course created a circumstance where all the critics who wanted to misrepresent what was there could find little bits and pieces to argue that the FBI had you know, not done the investigation correctly. And from the beginning, it was atrocious.
What we don't have to speculate about, however, Kurt, is that Hillary Clinton, her poll numbers simply collapsed after the Comey letter. As you point out, they fell from 85% to 65% certainty in terms of winning the race, and the Senate polls also changed. And also, millions of people have already cast their votes before he finally yesterday said, oops, I was wrong. And you point out, you know personally people who would have changed their votes or who did change their votes because of the Comey letter. So there's no question that the damage has been done. So in terms of motive, why then, at least the one thing that's obvious is this double standard over Russia's interference in our elections, which the intelligence community has gone public about. He apparently was reluctant to sign on to Clapper and the head of Homeland Security's announcement, but nevertheless did. Why sit on evidence about Russia and be so anxious to put out this very vague letter about Hillary Clinton's involvement in a tangential matter that she subsequently was cleared for?
Your listeners might have trouble believing this, but the reason he wouldn't, as I know Jim Comey, the reason he wouldn't sign on to the letter saying that the Russians were interfering with the election is because people told him he should. And the reason that he released the letter saying Hillary Clinton they were looking into new emails that might have something to do with the Clinton investigation was because people told him he shouldn't. Again, this is about Comey. This is not about Republicans or Democrats. This is about Comey and his the unmeasurable magnitude of his arrogance. He believed, based on, you know, what I've seen and folks I've spoken to, he believed he could perfectly thread this needle where he only revealed so much and people would go, oh, let's wait for Jim Comey to tell us more. And nothing would happen as a consequence. And he felt compelled to do it because of all the nonsense he had done in July, where he said way too much, went way beyond the rules. And so felt obligated, supposedly, to come out and say, oh, well, I told you the case was over, but now we're going to be looking at some more stuff, which is ridiculous. It's like saying no criminal investigation is ever completely closed until conviction. If more evidence comes across the transom, you look at it. You decide if it's worth doing or not. He was under no obligation to go out and say, gee, we found something. We don't know what it is. Maybe tomorrow he'll bump into somebody on the street who'll say, oh, I have evidence that Hillary Clinton, did XYZ. Is he going to run out and announce that? And it is until now, it has been an inviolable rule that law enforcement do nothing to create the appearance of an interference with an election. Even to the extent that you don't send out subpoenas, you don't bring an indictment, even if you're ready to do so. I mean, this is the major stuff you're not supposed to do. And the reason why is because it's not up to the FBI who gets elected president or congressman or senator. That's not their job. And people don't have the ability to respond. The abuse of power that Comey has engaged in the service of his own ego, is unprecedented. And, you know, you you have a circumstance now where you have a man in a very significant position of authority who has made it very clear that he is willing to abuse his power at any moment. We have another Hoover in office. And whether he is Hoover out of ill intent or arrogance, it doesn't matter. He has to go.
But is he, it's hard to know. I mean, Hoover, of course, apparently had a secret life that we won't go into. But in Comey's case, is there any suggestion about his personal political beliefs here? I know he was involved with that Whitewater inquiry into the Clintons early on, which was largely bogus. I also know that, for example, within the FBI, there is a kind of right-wing culture. Louis Free was a member of Opus Dei, and they recruit from Fordham. So is there any suggestion that he's a part of this sort of right-wing Catholic cabal that's been alluded to in the New York office?
No. And, you know, again, Comey is somebody who, you know, when he looks in the mirror, he sees someone who's above politics. He's not somebody who would allow himself to even momentarily think that he's acting on behalf of the group. He did this because he thought it was about his reputation. And he thought it was about, you know, I said I would keep them up to date, which he never should have said, you know, on the investigation. I said the investigation was closed, which he never should have said. And so now I have to make sure they know that what I said was, you know, now needs to be amended. I mean, think of all the times he's saying, I. And if you look through the statements he made to inside of the FBI, both when he did his nonsense in July and when he did it there, you know, just recently, it was all I. And, you know, that's what Comey cares about. And for him to actually sit there and think his reputation and, you know, his reputation as in which he put in play by breaking the rules to begin with in July, that his reputation is more important than our democracy, shows you the kind of person we're dealing with. And I would rather it was as simple as someone who was pushing for the Republicans. That's easy to understand. That's easy to deal with, you know. What you're dealing with here is someone who is pathologically driven by his own desire to buff up his belief in his own self-righteousness. I mean, one thing I've got to tell you is that I have no doubt Comey is furious right now, not because he made a mistake, because he won't acknowledge having made a mistake. He's furious because people are attacking him for political reasons and no one's willing to tell the truth. He would not be able to accept that what he did was an egregious abuse of power.
Kurt, would he accept the fact, and it's manifestly clear, that what he did had consequences? I'm furious with this guy just as a citizen because I don't want anybody interfering with the normal process of democracy, just as I'm furious about what Putin is up to. I mean, how blind can he be to the consequences of his act?
That's one I can't tell you. I don't know if he is capable of acknowledging, you know, facts. I mean, the fact that he can stand up and say that the Ferguson effect is true when all of the data shows that it's not. It shows somebody who acts on belief, not on fact. And, you know, one of the things about Jim Comey and his arrogance is that he has historically, whenever anybody really pushes back against him, threatened to quit. And I really hope he does that again. And I really hope that this time people take him up on it. Because, you know, think about it. His threat to quit is always, is always his go-to place, because my God, what a horrible thing for Jim Comey to leave. My bet is he will never threaten to quit again. He will either quit or he'll never threaten to quit again, because it won't take a fool. Or, you know, you'd have to be a fool not to recognize that everyone around him would love for him to say that now.
Well, just in closing, the FBI is an important part of the national security community, particularly in terms of domestic issues. And when Harry Truman signed the 1947 National Security Act, he was quite trepidatious about it and said to aides, "I hope I'm not creating a goddamn Gestapo here." The idea that you have high-ranking national security officials who may be acting out of arrogance or partisanship is very discomforting when it comes to national security, which is supposed to be really above politics.
Well, you know, if you read my column today, it sort of burns off the page. You know, I was literally trembling last night when he came out with a statement, because I was so furious. And, you know, my fury was based on the fact that, you know, he had violated the rules again, which he had to do because he violated the rules before, which he had to do because he violated the rules before, which, I mean, just keeps going back and back and back, and made it clear that all the chaos he caused was for nothing. And, you know, this is a man who cannot be trusted. He cannot be trusted in the position he's in. He cannot be trusted dealing with national intelligence. He cannot be trusted dealing with criminal prosecutions. He simply cannot be trusted. And I am actually somebody who has a good deal of affection for the FBI. I know a lot of agents. Most of them are actually very decent people. There does seem to be this group up in New York who are quite off the charts, and they should all be fired. They should be found, and they should be fired. And Jim Comey should be fired. You know, the FBI, the number of times people should say the FBI in an election is if they're watching a movie. You know, the FBI should have absolutely no role or whisper of a role in any election, for the very reason that that is the first step towards the demolition of democracy. If we want to start, in fact, there's someone I know who is from Africa and has just, you know, become a citizen and was going to vote. And he said, "This is just like the elections in my country, where everyone starts attacking, you know, but the government starts attacking one side as being, you know, the challenger as being a criminal, and starts bringing out information about that." And it was quite disheartening for me, for someone, you know, who was a new citizen, to be thinking, you know, American elections are as corrupt as the elections in my home country. That's what he said, in fact. And what a horror. What a horror. And, you know, the Chinese are actually making a great deal of fun of us, as we deserve. You know, we have caused, Jim Comey has caused enormous damage to the FBI, to democracy, to the American people, and to the world. And he's got to go.
Well, Kurt Eichenwalder, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Kurt Eichenwalder, who's a senior writer at Newsweek and a New York Times bestselling author, who previously worked for 20 years at the New York Times as an investigative reporter, columnist, and senior writer. He's a two-time winner of the George Polk Award for Excellence in Journalism and was a Pulitzer Prize finalist in 2000 and 2002, and is the author of The Informant and 500 Days, Secrets and Lies in the Terror Wars. And he has an op-ed at Newsweek, FBI Director James Comey is unfit for public service. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into how the press amplified the effects of the Comey letter.
Scandal. Now you left me, there's no healing the wound. Hey, scandal. Another one.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Eric Bollett, who is a senior fellow at Media Matters for America and the author of Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush, and Bloggers on the Bus, How the Internet Changed Politics and the Press. He worked for 5 years as a senior writer for Salon.com, where he wrote extensively about media and politics. And prior to that, he worked as a contributing editor for Rolling Stone. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric Bollett.
Thanks for having me.
And I take it that you find it kind of breathtaking that James Comey, the director of the FBI, threw a monkey wrench into the elections at the last minute, just in the home stretch. In a few days, Hillary Clinton's probability of victory collapsed from 85% to 65%. And now, as though nothing had happened, he rather blithely says, oh, there was no there. And, you know, no responsibility, no sense of the proportionality of what he did, no recognition. I mean, it's as though his personal reputation was more important than anything else, including American democracy.
Well, he's created a mess for himself. He's obviously not going to talk about it publicly. You know, the only time the FBI director really speaks publicly is or congressional hearings. It's not like he's going to have a press conference and try to hash this out. It was a disaster, and the takeaway from me is this is what happens when Republicans are able to bully people, right? If you go back to last July, Comey had his press conference. He announced that there was no criminal wrongdoing for anything that Hillary Clinton had done with her emails. I think he then tried to get too cute by a half and then threw Republicans some red meat. What did he say? She was extremely reckless, and he kind of lectured her about what she should have done. And I think he thought that was the end of it, because in the past, that's always been the end of it when the FBI closes an investigation. Comey never realized the Republicans in the House were then going to relaunch or redo the FBI investigation, and they were going to do it through hearings and leaks and things like that. So when these new emails showed up, and it turns out they were basically insignificant and they were all duplicates, I think Comey panicked. He realized if this gets out 2 days after the election, I will literally be run out of town by the Republican Party. I'd rather be at the target of Democratic wrath, which inside Washington, D.C. does not compare to Republican wrath. And so, you know, the Department of Justice told him, don't do this. The FBI guidelines say we don't do this weeks before an election. But again, I think he had been, between July and October, he had been so bullied by Republicans who promised basically to make his life hell in 2017 if he was still there, in terms of nonstop hearings about this FBI investigation, that he decided he had nothing to lose and that he had to placate this right-wing noise machine. And in the end, obviously, it was a catastrophe all the way around. For him, I don't think in the end it's going to matter to Hillary Clinton. I've never thought, you know, an inside beltway process story was going to swing an election. But it was an extraordinary thing to watch.
Right, but the press were fed this framing from yes. Jason Chaffetz, right out of the gate, this partisan Republican who said he was offended by right. Trump's remarks about grabbing women by the genitals, and then suddenly said, I'm going to vote for him again, and then dropped this framing on the press, which they dutifully picked up and ran with. I mean, you mentioned yeah. emails to the press. They go off, you know, like, you know, in a lather, like rabid dogs. And you mentioned Donald Trump's tax returns, which nobody seems to have been able to shame him into providing with.
Right.
Dead silence.
Right. In the old days, to get the press, the D.C. press, wildly excited about a scandal, a controversy, it had to be about sex. Right. If a scandal is about sex, everyone in the D.C. press sat up and was very, very interested. We have gotten to such a strange point now where if you insert emails instead of sex, you basically set off the same wild frenzy. I mean, it's completely bizarre. And you know, Media Matters has a piece up today. We've been writing about this for the last week or so. in terms of the sheer tonnage of Clinton email coverage, had clearly pushed aside any real attempt to cover her policies, you know, to cover anything that had to do with the Democratic platform. There was a study for the network news evening telecasts this year. ABC, CBS, and NBC, they devoted 125 minutes to Clinton emails, and they devoted 35 minutes to policy, not just Clinton policy, all candidate policy. So they spent nearly four times as much time covering emails than they did poverty, infrastructure, debt, climate change, social justice, racism, terrorism, healthcare, right, foreign policy, all of it combined.
Right. Well,
so, I mean, that's just one indication in terms of how far off the rails the press went with this fascination.
And zero time for climate change, the biggest issue facing mankind. So what's your sense then of any kind of mea culpa? I mean, I find it amazing to watch this race between a man who spews the most hateful, crazy stuff, is so manifestly ignorant. His record is unbelievably, you know, talk about lock her up, Hillary, and Hillary being a criminal. It's almost like what psychiatrists call displacement, where all of the terrible all the terrible things that he, the terrible person that he is, he's projecting onto her, and yet no criticism, no, you know, because I guess of this obsession about balance, where in the universe of discourse there's two equal and opposite opinions. Therefore, you know, she's slimed equally, and no proportionality, and I guess because they couldn't find much on her, they've made this email thing the equivalent of all the terrible things that Donald Trump represents.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So Donald Trump has this laundry list of really unprecedented amount of baggage in terms of his outlandish personal behavior, whether he's ripping people off with his charity, whether he's ripping people off with Trump University, whether he's a sexual predator. I mean, on and on it goes. So if you're on CNN and every night at 5 o'clock you host a show and you have to open up with some outrageous thing Donald Trump did, some outrageous new reporting about, you know, his business dealings and things like that. And then you look at the other side of the ledger and you're thinking, well, what are we going to do about Hillary Clinton, right? I mean, she's a very traditional, well-respected, amazing gold star resume. She's running a completely kind of straightforward, traditional Democratic campaign for White House. How are we possibly going to balance these two things? The larger question is, why do people feel there needs to be a balance? You know, the Republican Party took it upon themselves to nominate this guy. The press shouldn't then spend July, August, September, October, November trying to provide balance because one party has sort of gone into the fever swamp and nominated someone who is completely unqualified for the job and has all kinds of ugly traits. It's not the media's job to kind of cover that up or dress that up or make sure that he can, you know, he and Hillary Clinton look like the left-right version of each other, because they're not. So they struggled to kind of portray them, you know, one narrative was, oh, nobody likes either one of them. That was their favorite. You know, if they're going to compare them, they're going to decide, you know, they're both terribly unlikable. They don't inspire anyone. Nobody actually wants to vote for either one, et cetera. And another way they've tried to do it is pretend her, you know, the decisions she made for her electronic communications in 2009 is similar to Donald Trump spending $25,000 of charity money to buy a 6-foot portrait of himself. To me, those things are not equal in any universe.
Well, just in closing, Eric Bolet, why then did the press do this, particularly for a candidate who threatens the rank-and-file right. reporters on the campaign trail? You'd think that that in itself would institutionally make people say, wait a minute, this guy's going after us. And on top of right. that, the people that he riles up, his supporters, hate the press at any rate and don't believe a damn thing they say. So you're not going to be able to reach them in any case. So I just don't get it.
It's completely illogical, right? And if Hillary Clinton, I honestly think this is true in terms of her public rallies and speeches. I don't think she has uttered a mean-spirited sentence about the press this year. She has plenty of opportunity to critique it. She's not interested. She doesn't care about that stuff. She's interested in, you know, I think where this country is going, et cetera. Trump, as you say, has just unleashed this invective on the press, both himself, his surrogates, his supporters. And the press turns around and says, boy, Hillary Clinton has a problem with the media. You know, why does she distrust the media? And they look at Trump. I don't know the answer. I've always thought, you know, the D.C. press was wildly intimidated by Republican hardball. And this is the ultimate example of that. Sure. I mean, Republicans have been hitting the press for 40 years since Nixon and Agnew about the liberal media. There's this conspiracy to get Republicans, and that has been completely digested and processed within the Beltway media. And it's very effective. And there's a constant, I think, internal search to prove how are you not part of the liberal media? How are you not out to get the Republican Party? And Trump candidacy was the ultimate challenge. Either you call it like you see it, either you explain explicitly his lack of qualifications, you know, his business dealings, his personality traits, or you try to dress it up for the Republican Party. And as I said before, you try to present him as, you know, a mere opposite of Hillary Clinton, and it's just not possible. So I think the press is intimidated. I think the press is overly impressed by Republican hardball, and I think that only begins to explain some of the strange coverage we saw this campaign.
Well, Eric Bolet, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
All right, my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Eric Bolet, who is a senior fellow at Media Matters for America and the author of Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush, and Bloggers on the Bus, How the Internet Changed Politics and the Press. He worked for 5 years as a senior writer for Salon.com, where he wrote extensively about media and politics. And prior to that, he worked as a contributing editor for Rolling Stone. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about whether or not this election is between the uninformed and uneducated and the informed and educated. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Arthur Lapierre, who is a collegiate professor of political science at the University of Michigan. He serves on advisory boards of several science communication endeavors, including the Division of Behavioral and Social Sciences and Education at the National Academy of Sciences and Climate Central. He's also the chair of the American Political Science Association's Task Force on Improving Public Engagement, and is the author of a new book just out, Uninformed: Why People Seem to Know So Little About Politics and What We Can Do About It. Welcome to Background Briefing, Arthur Lapierre.
Thanks so much for having me.
And what's your sense then of this election? Can it simply be described in terms of Hillary Clinton's versus Donald Trump as the educated versus the uneducated?
I wouldn't put it that way. Here's the way that I start my book. I point out that there are two groups of people in America. And so I'll tell you about who they are. One group understands at some level that they're ignorant about so much of what happens in politics and government. If you think of all the laws that are passed or thought about at the federal level, at the state level, the local level, the county level, all the actions that are taken, all the rules that are promulgated, all the regulations that are enforced, some people realize that they're almost completely ignorant of all of it. So that's one group of Americans. The other group of Americans is delusional about how much they know. So there is no fully informed American. So the question then becomes, if we're all pretty ignorant of so much that happens in government, do we know the important things? And I think that's where elections get very interesting.
But how do we operate in a country where there's less and less of a consensus about what is true? People do what they call reality shopping. Christians get their information from Christian TV, liberals from MSNBC, conservatives from Fox. Well, let me ask you this. Was there ever a time when there was a consensus about the basic truths in the universe?
Well, the interesting thing about politics, not just in the United States, but in other countries, is politics isn't a venue where you can put facts in one pile and values in another pile and say they're separate. Politics is fundamentally about trade-offs. It has both technical criterion about what's true and what's false, and it has moral and ethical questions about what we should do, right? So there has always been, you know, people who prefer some facts over others because it aligns with a moral or ethical perspective that they have. But what I will say about the U.S. is that if we look at the entire course, the 230 years of U.S. history, well, let's just say, the rare period was the one, let's say, 10 to 40 years ago. And it was rare because there were very few places where lots of people could get information. So they tended to watch the same news programs and have very similar views of what was true. Now we do the reality searching. And prior to the television age and prior to the radio age, there were leaflets and there were competing newspapers in cities. And there were people in there were people in small towns who told their own versions of politics. And in that era, there were lots of different versions of truth going around. So the strange era in American political history isn't this one. It's the one before it in terms of what we might call convergence on truth.
Well, clearly the Internet is the epitome of trying to sort out the wheat from the chaff, and it's a kind of free-for-all in terms of reality shopping. Does that suggest then that, I mean, in other words, if we're in this new era where everything is kind of atomized and balkanized, is there any way that you can? I mean, I take it that what you're saying here is that even if you provide the facts, doesn't necessarily make people competent voters. You have to, before educating the public, you have to educate the educators. So walk us through right. What needs to be done in that regard, if indeed we are in a situation where there is no consensus on what is true anymore.
Yeah. Well, I'll give a different diagnosis first, and then I'll offer a remedy. What's interesting about the 2016 presidential campaign, it's not just the candidates. This is the first campaign where lots of people have had the ability to broadcast their views on social media. There are so many more people on Facebook and Twitter and Reddit and similar platforms than there were even in 2012. So we have this period where everybody can broadcast now and everybody can get an audience. And there's no precedent for that in human history. But these individuals, you know, myself included, I write about politics, you do shows, we're all competing for attention. And so some people seek attention by being outrageous. And so there's a kind of race to the bottom in that respect. And the presidential candidates have participated in that to some degree. So part of what's happening now that makes it seem so chaotic, it's not just that the values are different, though they are, it's really that everybody has a megaphone. So the question is, if there are essential things that people need to learn to improve their quality of life and that of their community, what do we have to do about it? And what my book is about and what the work I do is about is how to break through, how to break through the noise, how to find a way of talking about essential civic information, convey it in a way that people want to pay attention to it and think about it, and then we can start having conversations about how to build coalitions and take real affirmative or positive action on the issues of our day. But if we just call everybody who agrees with us or disagrees with us stupid, that's a conversation ender rather than a conversation starter. And unfortunately, it's the character of a lot of political communication today.
So there was a very extraordinary, rare speech that Justice Souter made back in 2012. He retired from the Supreme Court and rarely appears in public, but he did talk about, quoting Ben Franklin and Thomas Jefferson, saying that an ignorant people can never be a free people, calling upon the need for civic literacy and civic knowledge, and even predicted 5 years ago the emergence of a Donald Trump. Let's quick just play that clip, and then we'll get back to the conversation.
I think some of the aspects of current American government that people on both sides find frustrating are in part a function of the inability of people to understand how government can and should function. It is a product of civic ignorance. What I worry about is a remark that Benjamin Franklin made, and Susan Leahy quoted Jefferson at the beginning about how an ignorant people can never remain a free people. Democracy cannot survive too much ignorance. Franklin, in effect, had a comment to which the Jefferson comment is a kind of an answer or a response. And you probably have heard this, but it bears repeating. Franklin was asked by someone, I think, on the streets of Philadelphia shortly after the 1787 convention adjourned, what kind of government the Constitution would give us if it was adopted. And Franklin's famous answer was, a republic if you can keep it. You can't keep it in ignorance. I don't worry about our losing republican government in the United States because I'm afraid of a foreign invasion. I don't worry about it because I think there is going to be a coup by the military, as has happened in some other places. What I worry about is that when problems are not addressed, people will not know who is responsible. And when the problems get bad enough, as they might do, for example, with another serious terrorist attack, as they might do with another financial meltdown, some one person will come forward and say, give me total power and I will solve this problem. That is how the Roman Republic fell. Augustus became emperor not because he arrested the Roman Senate. He became emperor because he promised that he would solve problems that were not being solved. If we know who is responsible, I have enough faith in the American people to demand performance from those responsible. If we don't know, we will stay away from the polls. We will not demand it. And the day will come when somebody will come forward and we and the government will in effect say, take the ball and run with it. Do what you have to do. That is the way democracy dies. And if something is not done to improve the level of civic knowledge, that is what you should worry about at night.
And again, that was a clip from 2012 of Justice Souter, who retired from the Supreme Court, who was appointed by George Bush Sr., making a rare public appearance where he more or less predicted the emergence of a Donald Trump. So, Arthur LaPia, in terms of this populism now on the right and on the left that we've seen from both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, you've said that, and the TV show that where Donald Trump essentially pushed everybody off the island in the Republican presidential primaries. Obviously, he has an advantage being a reality TV star. You were quoted recently in a lecture you gave, it's so easy to be mesmerized by the national stage, but if that's all you focus on, you miss the amazing work being done to better everyone's quality of life. And that's what politics is about. So to my mind, that is, you know, what we're dealing with here, a pervasive and growing ignorance about the role of government.
Yeah, I see it a little bit differently in that, you know, when I made that quote, it was in response to a question like, should I be cynical? you know, when people look at the election and they see the vitriol and the divisiveness and the degrees of populism, you know, people are like, why would I bother with this? But the same forces we discussed earlier in the interview, the need for attention and so forth, our major news networks, CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, they could focus on the millions of Americans who every day are finding creative ways to work together and deal with their problems. They could focus on the hundreds of times per year that even this very divisive Congress that we have agrees on legislation. This last Congress, who people call the Do Nothing Congress, passed well over 100 laws, right? But what the news, you know, this isn't a conspiracy theory, it's just that they don't cover this stuff because people don't want to watch it. They want to cover the boxing match and the wrestling match and the people yelling at each other and so forth. So if that's all you focus on and you think that's what politics is about, A, it can make you cynical, and B, it's missing what's really going on. If we took all the people in this country who are working for government, in whether they're working at hospitals or for the military or in education, these are all part of government. If we put them into a hat and we randomly started picking people out, almost no one would be doing the things that we see people on TV doing, which is yelling and, you know, making outrageous promises. There are so many people involved in the political process that are working hard, they're listening, they're talking to other people, trying to figure out how to improve quality of life for children and the elderly and their communities and so forth. And that's what's at stake, right? And so we have the sensational, you know, it's not even the 1%, it's the most sensational fraction of 1% of the political process that we have 24 hours a day on TV, which can distract you from all the amazing things that people are doing in politics. And when I talk to young people, I'm like, if you just watch TV and think that's what it's all about, then politics is going to happen to you. But politics is something that all of us can be a part of, improving people's lives. And in doing that, you know, we need to think too about how do we reach people? How do we listen? How do we respond? That's what my work is really about.
But one of the explanations for this populist revolt on the left and the right, and it's not just happening here, it's happening in Europe as well, where major duopolies like the conservative versus the socialist duopoly in Europe, that's breaking down just as the Republican-Democratic duopoly here seems to be breaking down. One of the explanations is it's all about people are angry because of the failure of the elites. So how do you, and obviously the elites failed us in 2008 with the Wall Street crash, the Iraq war, there's no point in listing them all, it's pretty manifestly clear. So how do you deal with that in terms of the idea that we used to, at least as far as I know, we used to vote for people that we considered to be educated and experienced, and now since, say, Sarah Palin, we sort of vote for people who are sort of like us, you know, ordinary folk.
Yeah.
So it's kind of anti-elitism. How do you reconcile that?
Well, I can't speak for other countries, but I know in the U.S. for the 20th century, really until the 1970s, there were no primaries, right? So the candidates for office were chosen by party elites, and there was some politicking there, but there were certain values that people had, and the candidates that they proposed were by and large people who had experience in government. As we've moved through the last 40 years of primary election, this process has gotten away from party control and into popular control. So now we've moved to a place where we get different types of candidates. Now, the reason I think that things seem different on the Republican side, it's not just ideology. It's that since the 1960s, there's been a growing split within the Republican Party between what we call establishment Republicans and movement conservatives. And they really have pretty different beliefs about, you know, how the world should work. And part of what people like Donald Trump and Sarah Palin have been, they've really kind of moved into a vacuum created by the division within the party and created this space where they're not making a deeply kind of traditional conservative argument about government. They're making a different argument that takes little bits of what we call Tea Party movement conservative, little bits of establishment Republican, and try and wield a new story to get voters. But when you dig down, it's kind of not a coherent strategy for governing. And I think that's the sort of the bigger cause of what you see, at least on the Republican side. The Democrats haven't really experienced the same thing to that level over the last 30 years.
Well, just in closing then, Arthur LaPierre, It's often been a critique of the Democrats is that they don't have the kind of semantic framing that the Republicans have, that George Lakoff at Berkeley makes these arguments that Republicans are much better at framing stuff and that Democrats are afflicted by that 18th century Age of Enlightenment idea that if he who has the best argument wins, and they fail to understand the power of emotional intelligence. Just in closing, how do you, first of all, accept that divide? And again, I get back to, when are we going to have a consensus about the basic things, you know, that the sun rises in the east and sets in the west?
Well, I have to say that I think that George Lakoff's work on sort of framing generally is really good, but I'm less convinced of it when it's applied to politics. I think a better way to look at the difference between the Democrats and Republicans is that for the 60 years between 1933 and 1994, the Democrats controlled the House and the Senate for almost all of those periods. And so what that meant was the Republicans over time developed opposition party rhetoric as kind of their party line. So if we look at opposition parties around the world, their main line is there's too much government and the government's doing the bad things. And if you ask deep questions about, well, what would you do? The response is, well, government's too big and it's doing the wrong thing. So the opposition never has to answer the question. Because the Republicans were in the minority for so many decades in this country, I think there's a lot of people for whom being a Republican and being in the opposition party, they've just fused. People think it's one or the other. So I think that when we look at the, you know, so when Lakoff says, well, the Republicans are like your authoritarian father and the mother are like the Democrats are like your mother, I think there's a little bit of truth to that, but I think the better explanation is that the Republicans are just better, more comfortable at using opposition party rhetoric. So the Democrats are trying to articulate a rationale for a program, and the Republicans are saying, look, we just don't want to do, you know, we just want to do less of what the Democrats are doing. We want less Obamacare. We want less of that. So I think until you have a more competitive era where at least on the Republican side, they somehow manage their internal debate and are able to articulate a framework for what they would do in government as opposed to just what they wouldn't do, I think that's when the rhetoric between the Democrats and the Republicans will even out a little bit.
Well, Arthur LaPia, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Arthur LaPia, who's a collegiate professor of political science at the University of Michigan. He serves on advisory boards of several science communication endeavors, including the Division of Behavioral and Social Sciences and Education at the National Academy of Sciences and Climate Central. He's also the chair of the American Political Science Association's Task Force on Improving Public Engagement and is the author of Uninformed, Why People Seem to Know So Little About Politics and What We Can Do About It. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcast at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.